Let's jump back into our study in the book of Exodus, chapter number 16. And let's just summarize with verse number 31 what we've been talking about here. And that is the provision of God to the Israelites of manna, or what is it, as a flour or bread substitute for the time that they're going to spend in the wilderness. Exodus 31, or chapter 16, verse 31 says, "Now the house of Israel called its name manna." What is it? "It was like coriander seed," and I think that's the shape and relative size of it. Think about a coriander seed, how it's rounded, about that size. That would be roughly the size of a dewdrop when it dries up in the area around Israel's tents. And that's how manna, or manna, shows up, is in the drying of the dewdrops. "Then it was white," that's the color, "and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey." So it tasted a little bit like a bread product with a little bit of sweetener in it. Verse 32, "Moses said, 'This is what he who is has commanded. Let an omer of it be kept throughout your generations, so that they may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt.' Moses said to Aaron, 'Take a jar," a container, don't think a glass jar. In fact, we know that the one that it was eventually used was made of gold. "So take a jar and put an omer of manna in it." An omer would be one day's ration for an individual. And that's how much God is providing each day. So it's the perfect representative sample. "And place it before he who is to be kept throughout your generations." So it's to be kept as a memorial portion in the presence of God. Now at this point, God's visible presence seems to be centered on the tent that Moses is using for his day-to-day operations. So at this point, the container of manna is going to be probably in that tent. Later, the container of manna will be put in the tabernacle they'll build near the Ark of the Covenant. Eventually, it will be put inside the Ark of the Covenant. And you can see that mentioned in the book of Hebrews, chapter number 9. Verse 34, back in Exodus 16. "As he who is commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony to be kept." Now, the testimony mentioned here would be the Ten Commandments. That's coming up soon. And we know that the three items that make their way into the Ark of the Covenant include the two tablets of the Ten Commandments, second edition, because the first edition was broken, the golden container of manna, and the rod of Aaron and Moses, which budded and produced almonds. Those things will probably be placed into the ark once the wilderness experience is over. Verse number 35, "The people of Israel ate the manna 40 years till they came to a habitable land. They ate the manna till they came to the border of the land of Canaan." We know that that will happen after they cross the Jordan River, and they eat some of the Canaanite grain out of the fields for the very first time. So now they've got the Canaanite grain to eat. God stops providing the bread substitute. The manna ceases. The reason it will be 40 years in the future is because Israel screws up the chronology. Originally, the plan was that they would spend roughly a year, most of that at Mount Sinai, getting to know God, getting to know the covenant, building the tabernacle, constructing all of the things used in the tabernacle, getting the priests trained on how to do things, and then leaving Mount Sinai and making their way into the Promised Land by the spring of the following year. So the manna should have only lasted about 1 year. But because of the sinfulness of this generation and the penalty God assesses toward them, there will be an additional 39 years of wandering. And so that's a total of 40 years. But God doesn't pull the manna away. He continues to provide it during their entire time in the wilderness. Then we have a little note here in verse 36. An omer is the 10th part of an ephah. An omer, as I said, is roughly 2 liters. So think of a 2-liter pop bottle being filled with flour. That would be an omer of manna, or manna, a 1 day's ration for a person to use in cooking. Chapter 17 now. Verse number 1 says that all the congregation of the people of Israel moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages, according to the commandment of He Who Is, and camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. Now, before we get into the details of this next story, I want to remind you that Numbers chapter 33 has a more detailed list of the sites where Israel camped on their trip. And it lists a couple of sites in between the wilderness of Sin and Rephidim. And those sites would be Dophka and Alush. That's from Numbers 33, verses 12, 13, and 14. I believe that they were probably taking their time still as they're moving, and maybe the sites listed here are sites where they set up and spent a Sabbath followed by most of the following week. Because we know that Israel first arrived in the wilderness of Sin right around the 15th day of the second Jewish month. That's 1 month after they left Egypt. They could have got there a lot faster than that. So it seems like they were slowing down and taking their time once the armies of Egypt were no longer pursuing them. And so the same seems to happen after they have been given manna for the first time. They take their time at the next couple of sites. Now, I've shared with you that Sin is the root for Sinai or Sinai. And I think there's a lot of confusion because of things from the past of trying to identify the modern-day Sinai Peninsula as to where Mount Sinai is located. In fact, the traditions put it way down in the southern tip of the Sinai Peninsula. Excuse me. That does not make any sense based on the chronology and the geography that we know about the wilderness experience. We know that Mount Sinai had to be close to Midian. Midian is located east of the Gulf of Aqaba arm of the Red Sea. We also know that Israel crossed the Red Sea very shortly after they left Egypt, so that seems to be the Gulf of Suez arm that they must have crossed. And then a couple of stopping sites later, they are at the Red Sea again, which seems to be the Gulf of Aqaba part of the Red Sea. So they were describing a line from the delta following an ancient highway southeast toward Midian. And so that means when they were in this wilderness of Sin that we're talking about right now, they were already on the east side of the modern-day city of Aqaba. And Rephidim, I believe, is kind of the last stop on their way to Mount Sinai itself. And I've shared with you my conviction that Mount Sinai is more than likely going to be associated with a place that is currently called Yamal Adami. It's the highest mountain in the country of Jordan, but it is right on the border between Jordan and Saudi Arabia, and it's about 30-some miles south and east from the modern city of Aqaba. It has a secondary name for the peoples who speak Arabic, and that is, I got sidetracked here. I went too quick on my connections. This mountain is part of a region in southern Jordan that is called the Wadi Rum. That's Wadi, which is just, I think it's an Arabic word for a wet weather stream. And then Rum, R-U-M. Wadi Rum is a wilderness region in southern Jordan. A lot of tourists go there because it's got nice, majestic, open, clear skies. Some great hiking is what I understand, and lots of interesting vistas. One of the great vistas is climbing up to the top of Jamal Adami, what I believe is probably Mount Sinai, because you can see on all sides from up there on the peak. But the other name for the Wadi Rum area is the Valley of the Moon. Now, why is that a big deal? Because as I shared with you a couple of sessions ago, the word seen here is actually the name of an ancient god of the moon. He had a lot of followers up in Mesopotamia, but he was known to be followed all the way through the Arabian Peninsula, even into fairly modern times. The pre-Islamic peoples were still worshiping the god Sin, the moon god. So I believe that the wilderness of Sin here is basically the wilderness of the god of the moon. So that ties it in with the Wadi Rum area of southern Jordan. So those are all my opinions on it as to why I use this as the location for the Mount Sinai in the things that I talk about. Okay, so they're making their way toward this mountain where Moses had the burning bush experience and where God said, you're going to bring them back here for me to meet with them. They arrive at the second to last stop on this trip at a place called Rephidim. And there's no water to drink. None. It's just dry. And so, verse 2 of Exodus 17 says, therefore, the people quarreled with Moses. They start having a fit again. They start griping and harassing him. In fact, the word in Hebrew is the word for a lawsuit. So they basically want to bring him up on charges, because this journey is nothing like they thought was being advertised. They thought that they were being brought out of Egypt and taken to a land of promise, a land flowing with milk and honey. And instead, they're out in the middle of nowhere where there's no water and no food. Now, forget about the fact that God's been providing them food. They are mad because they have now run out of water again. Verse 2, therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, give us water to drink. And Moses said to them, why are you quarreling with me? Why do you test he who is? So why are you putting God to the test with all of this? Because Moses only works for God. When they gripe to the prophet Moses, they're actually griping to God. When the prophet Samuel later will kind of feel bad because he thinks that the people of Israel in his day are rejecting his leadership, God reminds him, no, they're not rejecting you, Samuel. They're rejecting me because you represent me. And something similar goes on with Bible-believing, Bible-preaching, Bible-living preachers. If people have a problem with what they're preaching, they don't really have a problem with the preacher. They got a problem with the material he's using, which is the Word of God. And that's always a bad sign, isn't it? If you've got a problem with God's Word, that means you've got a problem with God. Verse number 3. But the people thirsted there for water, and the people grumbled against Moses and said, why did you bring us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? So once again, he's being accused as being the bad guy in this. That somehow all of this was a plot to drag them out of Egypt so that they could be killed somewhere else. So Moses cried to He Who Is, what shall I do with this people? They're almost ready to stone me. And He Who Is said to Moses, pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel, take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. So Moses is told, I want you to get a little group together, the leadership group. I would assume it's probably the 70 leaders of Israel at this time. That's the number of names that went into Israel, went into Egypt, and somewhere along the line, they must have adopted that as their traditional leadership council. That's why the Sanhedrin, even later in the time of Jesus, has 70 members. So probably he takes these 70 guys, along with Aaron, along with the rod, and they trek farther beyond Rephidim to Mount Sinai itself. And the reason they're going ahead is because what's about to occur needs to supply water to the next encampment, not just simply the one they're at right now. Verse number 6, behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and the water shall come out of it, and the people will drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. So Moses and the elders of Israel, they trek farther ahead, actually to Mount Sinai. God shows Moses which particular rock he wants him to strike. Moses strikes that rock one time, and water begins flowing out of this rock. So a brand new spring. And it's not just a trickle, it is a gusher. And this starts filling the wadi that runs off from Mount Sinai area and will eventually make its way down into the Gulf of Aqaba area. So a brand new river has been inaugurated here. This river is going to run right past the Rephidim encampment and provide them water there. And this is going to be their water supply for the next year. Just constantly gushing. And if you think about how much water, 600,000 men plus the women and the children and the animals consume in a single day, this must be a really, really good aquifer of water that's being poured out here. God is providing miraculously for them. So then they go back to the Rephidim encampment, and it gets another name. He called the name of the place Masah. Masah in Hebrew means, let me get the literal meaning here, temptation or testing. And Meribah is built on that word we were talking about a while ago, about a lawsuit, a place of strife or a place of contention. So this Rephidim becomes the site of trouble and testing and argumentation because the quarreling of the people of Israel and because they tested he who is by saying, is he who is among us or not? So that's what they'd been telling Moses before he took the elders and went and got this supernatural water. Either God's with us or he's not with us. Come on. We're gonna thirst to death out here unless you do something. So now God has provided. We'll come back to another bit of problems that happen at this place once they break camp after they've met with God at Mount Sinai for about a year. Now we run into another problem. And that is a group of people related to the Israelis distantly that have developed an attitude of slavery. That basically, if you can grab people and sell them on the open market as slaves, it's perfectly fine to turn a profit that way. And that would be the Amalekites. So verse 8, then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. So Amalek is looking at this as a whole bunch of escaped slaves, which technically they are. But they are actually under God's protection, so they are not up for grabs. And so God is going to intervene here. Verse number 9. So Moses said to Joshua. Now this is the first time we've met him. He started out in his life with the name Hoshea, which means salvation all by itself. But because he's working for Moses as Moses' attaché, Moses' assistant, Moses gives him a new name. He adds a shortened form of the divine name, Yahweh, so just the Yah part of that, to the front of the word for salvation, Hoshea. And now this man's name is Yehoshua, or he who is salvation. And this is also the name of Jesus. And so we see Jesus kind of encoded here as the next leader of the Israeli people because he's coming up under the leadership of Moses. At this time, Joshua would be in his 40s. We know that because of later indications of what his and Caleb's names are at the end of the Exodus during the conquest. So Moses said to Joshua, his attaché, choose for us men, and then go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. So Amalek is making threatening motions toward the Israelis, that they're basically going to recapture these escaped slaves and sell them back, probably to Egypt. And Moses' response is, no, they're not. Joshua, you need to get a strike force together and be ready for tomorrow to defend the people of Israel with the power of God. I'm going to be up on the hill above you with God's staff of power in my hand, and you're going to go out there and fight. So Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek while Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. So we know Moses, we know Aaron. Hur is the husband of Miriam. So this is their brother-in-law. And so these three leaders, these three male leaders, go up on the top of this hill. Verse 11, whenever Moses held up his hand Israel prevailed. That's the way it's kind of working. He holds the rod up, and the energy of the battle goes in favor of Israel's fight. But if he starts lowering his hand, then Amalek's starting to win. Whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. Now, it doesn't say that Israelis died when Amalek prevailed. It just said that they started getting on the other side. Because Amalek's not trying to wipe them out. Amalek is trying to capture these guys because they are slave dealers. Verse 12, but Moses' hands grew weary. Not a surprise. So they took a stone and they put it under him, and he sat on it, while Aaron and Hur held up his hands on one side, one on one side and the other on the other, and so his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. And this is where we get that imagery about cooperative leadership, about how we need to uphold others in their efforts, because there is a benefit to that. Because one person might get tired on their own, but when you've got several persons working at it, several persons upholding one another, then the job can get done. And so Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the sword. So they win the day, and Amalek is defeated. But we're out of time for the day. But the rest of the story we're going to get to tomorrow is that God predicts that Amalek is going to be a perennial problem, going to consistently cause trouble for the Israelis until they're taken out of the way. And so he makes a notation in the history at this time that at a later date, there will be a removal of Amalek to keep them from ultimately annihilating the Israeli people.